passed away when I was 18, which was pretty wild because I had a daughter when I was 18 as well. So it was like in the same month, like becoming a father and losing one, just like 3 weeks apart, which was a bit of a brain melter, especially at 18. And I was working with him as a motor mechanic and also living at home still. So like all of a sudden I just woke up one day and just had like nowhere to live, no job, and a dependent who's like 3 weeks old. Didn't even have a car at the time. Like I was just, yeah, it was a real crazy time. But what I say, it's like some of the worst things in life were the best things that happened to me, blah blah blah. And for me, it just taught me resilience and just also taught me that the only thing that people can't take away from you is what's between your ears, you know, your knowledge. People can take everything from you, strip you right back, but if you've got some good stuff in your brain, then you'll be right generally.
Dave talks about a moment where his father passed away when he was 18 and he had a 3-week-old daughter, and he had to do a lot of growing up very quickly, left home when he was 15. And then we sort of unpacked the mindset that he shaped to get where he is today with his company. So a marketing company that's doing really well on the conversion front and optimizing that for the company. So if you want to get a better understanding of your mindset, how to navigate challenging moments in your life, there'll be a good podcast for you. Or if you're a business owner that's a little bit confused about social media and wants to get a little bit more clarity on sort of what to be aware of and how to make your campaigns more conversion optimized. So let's kick into it.
I think a good starting point, even though we won't go like every age of your lifetime, but where were you born?
Whangarei. In the Whangarei. Naughty North.
The Naughty North.
Yeah.
What was it like in Whangarei? Were you, you know, the popular kid, the nerd? Were you the jock? Were you the emo?
Well, I spent my like high school years in Whangarei, but leading up to that, we moved around a lot. Went to like 7 different primary schools, which was interesting because it definitely taught me to be adaptable and to be able to mesh into a lot of situations, but it was a pain in the ass and not fun being a kid moving around all a whole bunch. You can't really build your networks quite strongly, dig your roots nice and deep. But it taught me adaptability so that by the time I started high school, intermediate in Whangarei, I was pretty good at sort of controlling the social dynamic of things. And then moved out of home really young. And just went flatting, and we'd have like a housewarming party and then like 6 months later an eviction party and then another housewarming party a couple of months later. The eviction parties were always way more fun than the housewarming.
yeah, imagine, brother.
Yeah. Yeah, but just that process throughout my teenage years was just epic and generated a lot of contacts through that, which was cool. Unfortunately, most of the contacts I don't really leverage these days because they're I mean, I'm just on a different path these days and stuff.
Yeah, it was strategically exactly. Explained.
would have been handy if I was living in Auckland at the time, but hey-ho, yeah.
Yeah, just on that, so you said you're moving a lot and a whole lot of different schools. Hmm. Why? What was going on?
Yeah, just my mum's a bit of a nomad, love it a bit. She's been on a real crazy journey my whole life, and she's only really come right in the last, it's been a while now, actually, 5-6 years. But it's been a bloody rocky journey, and I'm just glad that I'm in a position these days to be able to help her through that. Like, she doesn't have to do anything now. Built her a little house on it. We've got a lifestyle block, and I just built her a little house up in the back paddock, and she can just chill out and do the gardening, not have to stress, you know. So, yeah.
And Dad?
He actually passed away when I was 18, which was pretty wild because I had a daughter when I was 18 as well. So it was like in the same month, like becoming a father and losing one, just like 3 weeks apart, which was a bit of a brain melter, especially at 18. And I was working with him as a motor mechanic and also living at home still. So like all of a sudden I just woke up one day, it was sudden out of the blue too. And just had like nowhere to live, no job, and a dependent who's like 3 weeks old and like didn't even have a car at the time. Like I was just, yeah, it was a real crazy time. But I think what I say, it's like some of the worst things in life were the best things that happened to me, blah, blah, blah. And for me, it just taught me resilience and just also taught me that the only thing that people can't take away from you is what's between your ears, you know, your knowledge. People can take everything from you, strip you right back, but if you've got some good stuff in your brain, then you'll be right generally. And that's why you see all these people that go through hell and bounce back again and again and again, you know. It's because they've got that mental toughness, the resilience and things. So it was a gift. Now that I look back at it 12 years later, you know.
What was it at the time for you? Like, how did you, because you're tied between, you know, you're transitioning to adulthood and you have to grow up very quick for this young son or daughter?
Daughter.
Young daughter. Yeah. And then you're the person that you've been leaning on and sounds like a close relationship with.
Mm.
What happened then? Like, did you go off the rails? Did you completely withdraw and harden up? Or what was your...
Yeah, so like you say, it just grows you up quick, which for me was good because I had a few bad habits I had to shake, and it just gets them out your system real fast. Necessity is a crazy thing. It really shows you what you're capable of, I find. And I've got friends who've never been through any adversity, and small things happen to them and they just crumble, you know? So definitely was a crazy time, and I did go off the rails for probably about a year while I was just figuring stuff out, maybe 6 months, and I was still flattened with all the lads and things, so it was a bit crazy. But after about a year in this flat, I think it was like six dudes living there, and not with my daughter's mother, so it was just like six lads and then this baby, and I'm always trying to like pick up all their stuff and tell them to shut up, and I'm like making the place tidy and putting all the toys away. It was absolute carnage. And after that period of time, I just had enough, and I was like, all right, zoomed out, look at my life, just sort of looked at all the things that had happened, the cards that I'd been dealt, and just thought, you know, what's the best hand that I can play? Because adversity is interesting. You can either use what's happened to you as justification to make bad decisions, or you can use it as fuel on the fire. So I just sort of took all these things and I'm like, all right, what do I want to do? At the time, I had to leave the mechanic shop, of course, and I was working as a mechanical engineer, which these days I just weld for fun, or like work on cars and fix stuff for fun as opposed to a career. And at the time, just realized I didn't want to do it for the rest of my life. Wanted to put the tools down and actually do something that was a bit more scalable. Always been quite entrepreneurial, so just looked at the business model of an engineering workshop, and you need like $500,000 capital to kick it off, and it's like risky as big contracts, people don't pay, people fold all the time, and just sort of zoomed out and thought, all right, what do I want to do? And then just buggered off to Auckland. I quit school at 15, so just signed up for uni and somehow got in. It's, if you're over 20, you get in real easy or something, I don't know. So I was 20 at the time, and just went to Massey, did my degree, did a major in entrepreneurship, which is kind of like ironic because you don't really need a degree in entrepreneurship, but when you're from the naughty north, you kind of need to learn how to talk the talk a little bit, and just make contacts and meet people and stuff. So I found it really beneficial. All these entrepreneurs saying you don't need uni and stuff, but I think for some people it's good. There's kind of no downside to it.
What do you learn?
Well, for me, it was just like the fundamentals of business. And also, I remember this one time, right? Like, I'm doing my own research while I'm studying, and I go to the lecturer and I'm like, all right, at what point are we going to learn how to do sales? Who's going to teach me selling? Blank face. They're like, oh, I don't know. I go talk to this guy, talk to the next guy. Who can teach me how to sell? Is there anyone at the campus who can actually teach sales? Blank face. And then one of them put me onto the guy who was running the Massey eCentre, which is the equivalent of like the Ice House, like a business incubator thing. And I met the guy who was running that, who I'm actually still mates with now. He's a good lad. And he just squeezed me through for like the scholarship of it. So it's like $5,000, and that you can develop your business. I didn't even have a business at the time, but we just got along. And he taught me some really good sales things, but his best piece of advice for me was just go work in door-to-door selling.
Yeah.
Because it's just like a crash course in how to sell. And if you can do that, mate, you can bloody sell anything. It's grueling. It's awful. It's the shittest job I ever had to do. It was hell, but it was great because it just taught me how to sell.
Was it Abco?
Abco, yeah.
It's always fucking Abco.
It's brilliant. And I'd recommend that to any young person, because I think sales is just the most beneficial skill you can get as a young person before anything, if you want to get into business, of course. But it's just the sort of art and the science of persuasion, right? Which comes in handy in a lot of different situations. So, no, again, no real downside to it. And I got loads out of that. I went from that door-to-door into, man, I was working at a call center for a bit. Again, yeah. Grueling, awful, but fantastic. I was working from 6 p.m. till 3 in the morning, because in my mind I was like, cool, there's this wicked job. I can work all night and hustle all day and I can build my empire. But you don't think, you know, you finish work at, you work at till 3 a.m. in like fluoro lights. You're not going to go home and just jump straight into bed. You're bloody wired, you know. You're like, all right, what's next? So I'm not getting to bed till 9, 10 a.m. Sleep until like 3, 4 p.m. Got a couple of hours and then you go back and do it all again. It was hell, but I mean, good money and things if you're good at it. So
yeah, there's not... I don't think it's talked about enough. I think recently that in Denmark, nurses that work shifts won a case because of the impact it has on their health.
Oh yeah.
And it's and there's actually people that have depression and anxiety tend to get exposure to the sun around that time after nine.
Oh yeah.
And when you first wake up, this is from Huberman Labs, if you ever want to look at it. It's a professor at Stanford. He goes through how to optimize your sleep. And essentially, when you get light, when you first wake up, you get a dose of cortisol and adrenaline.
Okay.
And that's to start you off and get you moving. But if you get that too late, then it's not necessarily healthy. So if people are continually having these fluorescent lights late at night, not getting sun exposure at the right time, because from 9 to 12, it's called the circadian dead zone. So you're not actually impacting your rhythm in any way. Did you notice, like, I remember I was just working, I didn't see light or people, and I was just like sad.
Yeah, Rex, yeah.
I was just like, fuck.
It wrecks, yeah. And I found that too. It just, I was a shell of a man, you know, I was not all there. And it just slowed down my thinking. I didn't really learn from that lesson at the time because, you know, when I'm, you know, throughout the 20s, you're just hustling, you're just bloody. I work better at night, unfortunately, because there's no distractions, of course. And I sort of get on a roll at the sacrifice of the following day because I'm an absolute just potato. I can't do anything. And it's only been within the last probably 3 years where I've actually focused on my sleep. I read that book, Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. And I'm reading it and I almost wanted to shut it and chuck it away. I was like, no, like you're taking away from my hustle. This is bad. But yeah, after reading that, it's like, okay, like this is actually pretty important. I should probably focus on this. And fast forward to now, like, yeah, it's so much better. Just getting a solid 7-8 hours every night. I mean, I'm not perfect, but I'm way better than what I was. And if you sort of look at the last 6 months of your life with decent sleep, it's just so much more impactful than what it would be otherwise. Yeah, it's good.
Well, there's a thing in that book, they talk about chronotypes, and I don't think it's not that supported at the moment, but it makes evolutionary sense where you have early birds and night owls because, you know, it protects us against
harm. Keeps the pack alive, yeah.
Because someone's keeping watch.
Mm.
But I think, yeah, like the mistake people make is they're still either managing or running a business like it's the industrial age, and the most valuable resource even in sales is passion and creativity. So if you're continually burning at both ends and trying to sell, your tonality's not there, your confidence is not there, your ability to problem solve, to close the deal. So it's interesting. You almost have to like do less to get more.
Yeah. And I think that just comes down to structuring your day correctly, because I think if you're too busy, then your systems are broken. Something's not working properly. You need to plan better or delegate more or do something. And if you're at a point in your life where you just need to, you need to work till 2, 3, 4 a.m., then like I say, you need to fix something about that. It's unsustainable. It's unhealthy. You feel like you're doing a bunch of stuff, but you know, just because you're going full speed doesn't mean you're in the right direction.
True. So what are your tools or routines that you use that you found helpful?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm stupidly bloody routine oriented. I got a good morning routine that works well. Keep into my sleep. I got my big goals list that I review annually. Every year I sort of knock a few off, and anything that's not completed, I just put it forward to the next year, but it's like hyper ambitious and it's pretty big. And then, that is broken down to like the 5 main areas of my life, you know, business, family, health and fitness, my hobbies and my mindset. And I sort of try not to have too many goals in each area, because if it's too big, it just doesn't happen. It's like those ones who write the business plan that sits under the bed forever, as opposed to the lean canvas where it's like one document, you know. So that in the morning, I check them every day, my big annual goals list. It only takes like 5 minutes, but like reviewing them regularly means that you catch yourself if you start to deviate from them, you know. So although I know exactly what they are, it's just like I'm reinforcing it. And just like really zoning in on each of them, not just like skim reading. It's just like I'm reading it nice and slowly, mindfully. I only do like 5-10 minutes of meditation a day. I find that's enough for me. As long as I do it every day. I find that, usually at the start of the day, sometimes at the end of the day. But when you're doing stressful stuff, so long as you know that there will be peace within 12 hours, it's okay. It helps me to get through those. Quick calisthenics workout every day. I'm not trying to get big and bulky with these big gym SpongeBob muscles. I just want to be like strong and motivated and like be able to get out of bed quicker and run around with my daughter and stuff, you know. So it's like functional strength and maintaining as opposed to constant growth. Just moving in the morning, I think, helps a lot. And then I'll just get straight into my day. It only takes an hour. I call it my hour of power.
Yeah.
As cheesy as it sounds.
When do you start your hour of power?
I usually get up at 6:30 and then just spend half an hour just like waking up, have a cup of coffee and stuff. And then, yeah, 7 to 8.
Well, the only thing that sounds like an amazing routine, the Huberman lab, he talks about. So with caffeine, it doesn't necessarily give you energy, but it blocks your adenosine receptors.
Blocks the receptors, yeah. And that's why I can't have coffee after midday, because the receptors are blocked until too late in the day. I can only have it in the morning. If I miss my morning coffee, I just don't have a coffee that day.
Well, he talks about trying to wait 90 minutes before your first coffee.
Oh, really?
Just okay. So you can clear out the adenosine.
Okay. From the prior day or something.
Yeah, so okay. Clear it out because you're about to block it.
Yep.
And then it has a much more positive impact. But I mean, most nutrition pseudoscience, because you don't know, it's a lot of variables. Do you think, I haven't obsessed over my goals every morning for a long time. I did it for a stint, like a few months.
Yeah.
And I noticed when I was thinking about what I wanted, I kept finding solutions on how to get there because I fixated on it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, everyone talks about the law of attraction and all this, like it's magic. It's not magic. It's just a matter of being clear. It's like, you know, the concept of your reticular activation system, your RAS. So if you're repeating it to yourself every day, then your RAS detects something that could help in line with that journey. And it also prevents you from, like I say, deviating on the wrong track. And it just helps you to find the opportunities when you otherwise just wouldn't be thinking about it enough to identify them. Because a lot of the time there's opportunities that could help you in your direction, like just right in front of you, that you're just not even picking up on because you're not thinking about it enough and you're not clear enough in your goals. 90% of it is just clarity, I reckon. So important.
Yeah, and people listening, reticular activation system, kind of think of it like Google for your brain.
Yeah.
Whatever you put in, you find.
Mm.
And it's not woo-woo, like.
Yeah.
You can look up reticular activation system. It helps with a few things. Okay, meditation, because I'm a big believer in meditation and get complacent. I actually, the only meditation I consistently do is when I'm talking to other people or observing as I move.
Okay, you meditate while you speak.
Yeah, okay. So for example, I might get really anxious and overwhelmed talking to someone.
Hmm.
So I'll just ground it on my breath and then on them.
Okay.
Because often they talk about in Landmark Forum, though I'm not a believer in them, but I went to one session, the already always listening voice. So normally I'd think, how does this impact me? Should I try and think of something charismatic to say while you're talking? Huh. I'm not listening.
Okay.
So I try to focus on you. So then when a silence presents itself, then a natural question will unfold.
Ah, okay.
So what are your lessons in terms of meditation? Like, what have you taken from it?
Well, there's like so many different ways of meditating and everyone's got a different take on it. For me, I'll either do focused meditation or unfocused. Unfocused, you know, where I'm just trying to switch my brain off. I'll just try and think about nothing for 5 minutes, which I just love. You sort of get into a bit of a trance and you just zone out and it's brilliant. And after that, you just feel like your batteries are a little bit recharged. Especially if I'm feeling a little bit, you know, like stressed out or anxious or something like this. Just switch the brain off for 5 minutes and breathe. And alternatively, then I'll do focused meditation where I'm just trying to practice an emotion like gratitude, for example. I love gratitude meditation because I think it's like pretty much any negative emotion and gratitude are mutually exclusive. You can't be angry and grateful at the same time. Like, it's really freaking hard. You're one or the other. So if you just practice gratitude, I also find that if you've got lots of gratitude and lots of willpower, then like, mate, the world's your oyster. You can do anything. You mix those two things together and it's just like, well, bang. I mean, everyone knows about that bloody study they did on all the monks who do gratitude meditation. And it's like they put them under the MRI scan, the ones who meditate on gratitude for an hour a day, and their ability to feel gratitude was like a million times greater than just your everyday office worker. A lot of people don't practice gratitude enough, and it's like they're dwindling that part of their brain. And that's why you get like midlife crisis, like stressed out, because you just forget how to feel grateful. So I think specifically focusing on that again, no real downside. What's it gonna, it's only ever gonna be a good thing.
Well, it makes sense. Like, I can often tell a person's belief system based on the words they use to describe themselves.
Yeah.
Because same thing with the words, thoughts, feelings, actions. Over time, you link that to your identity.
Yep.
So, like, I often say that I'm afraid of talking to people. So every time I say that, I become closer to that and keep it reinforced.
Mm.
And you're talking about fixating on gratitude as a means, and that will probably start developing neural pathways, and you start something you look for.
It's like a muscle.
Yeah. How do you balance acceptance with gratitude? Because on one hand, I get if you focus on this, you can't focus on two things.
Hmm.
But how do you integrate unresolved emotions or traumas if you're in a way avoiding it?
Yeah, I mean, unpopular opinion for me, I just switch all that shit off. It drives my missus crazy. She reckons I'm suppressing things, but it's served me well my whole life. I've been through some stuff, and I just don't focus on it. Like you said before, the more you think about it, it develops neural pathways. And if you're focusing on sad shit too much, like, it's just going to strengthen that, and it's going to be too hard to break. I reckon that's what causes depression in a lot of people, you know? It's like you're that's the narrative at the moment, is just to, like, feel it out and talk about it lots and lots and lots and lots. Like, you're just dwelling on things for hours and hours and hours as you're drifting off to sleep thinking about this bad thing that happened to you. Whereas for me, I've just developed ways where I can just kill those thoughts and I'll think about something else. And again, like, I'm sure there's all these studies that say you shouldn't do that, but it's served me incredibly well. So I would never do anything else. And then also, just on that acceptance point, one thing that's helped me a lot, well, I mean, it's like this whole balance between you know, growth and achievement and then contentment. I think it's important to remain, like, grateful for what you have, but you get too grateful, you don't want to grow, and you want to grow too much, and it's really hard to be grateful for what you have, you know. But my solution to that is to separate your goals from your happiness, making happiness a goal in itself. It's like, happiness is something that I do all the time, whereas goals are something that I focus on as well, but not placing my happiness within my goals. A lot of people do that. It's like, I'll be happy when, you know, but just separating them. It's like, I'm going to be happy all the time, but I'm also going to have these goals that I check every single day. But my happiness is not dependent on the goals. Yeah,
I get it. Okay, is there a cost to your approach that you've noticed, whether it's the depth of connections with others, whether it's hard to...
Yeah, I'm definitely... I mean, it's getting pretty deep, but I'm not very good at giving people advice when it comes to all that side of things. Like, if they're, getting real upset about something, and, like, sometimes people just want to vent, and that's cool, but I'm very solutions. I've gotten better. Because it drives my missus crazy. She's a very emotive type. She's, like, big on emotions and all this sort of thing. And like, my approach would just be like,
hard nut, move on.
Yeah, pretty much. Have a cup of concrete. But, you know, people aren't going to receive that well. So I just sort of switched that off. And I saw this cool thing the other day, and it was like, the husband asked the wife, "Do you want comfort or do you want solutions?" You know, like, do you just want do you want me to be here while you vent, or do you actually want me to come up with some practical solutions? Give them the choice, because a lot of the time people just want to have a moment where they vent, as opposed to actually, like, do this, do that. Here's a bullet pointed list. I'm going to check back in a week. You know, like, nah.
Is it hard to talk about it every week because they just keep venting?
Yeah, well, some people are just venters, but I don't know. That's the thing. Like attracts like.
What sort of people do you attract in your life?
Similar.
Either in business or... Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, just everyone I talk to, like, I...
Cutthroat executors.
Well, yeah, it's like, I went out to dinner with some friends last night, and, you know, it's like, one of the early questions in the conversation is, you know, like, what are your big hyper-ambitious goals for the year? And we had a real meaningful conversation about the massive things this person's doing, like, hugely impactful things, like, massive, massive. And I just love those types of conversations. It's fascinating to me. And saying that, though, like, I think everyone has something to give. Everyone has some value. Again, drives the missus crazy sometimes. Like, I'll just talk to anyone, because you can always navigate the conversation to a point where you can get some value, whether it's just their perspective on things, or a suggestion for something, or their take on a experience they had, or something like this. So yeah, I mean, I'll talk to anyone, but I mean, the people that I hang around with are generally quite goal-oriented these days.
Are they happy?
It's like half-half. I think a lot of the goal-oriented people aren't overly happy. It's because they're putting their happiness in their goals, you know? It's, I'll be happy when. And I always try to tell them that, to separate those two. Easier said than done, though. You know, you can give people advice, but they're never always going to take it. And I mean, who am I to give advice? You know, I'm only bloody 31. It's like all these people on the internet, these gurus that are in their 20s and stuff. It's like, ah, maybe one day.
Yeah, I think it's about repetition. You know, you may, I don't know how to say the word, calisthenics.
Calisthenics, yeah, it's
Yeah.
just body weight training.
So you might be exceptionally further along than anyone in their 60s in your knowledge and comprehension of that subject.
True.
So you're not necessarily having to minimize your contribution based on your age. So yeah, so I can sort of see how you've navigated the so really challenging moments in your life. You had to find a way, you had to grow up. Period of like, this is too hard to deal with. I'm just gonna have fun and hedonistic lifestyle, so to speak. And then making goals like your drive, but then realizing there's not enough joy in that in itself. So then you've created this other pocket, which is your happiness and contentment doesn't derive from your ability to achieve or not achieve those goals.
Correct.
Which means that sort of approach, I think the pros of it is that you, irrespective of what happens in your life, you'll find a way through it. And then also you'll probably reach a high level of success in terms of what you want. I guess the challenge you might face is the depth of connections with the people that you connect with, because they might not be able to relate to that approach, or you might withhold or not express certain things because they don't serve you.
Yeah, well, I mean, depth of connection is an interesting one, especially as you get into your 30s, because everyone's so freaking busy, right? When you're at high school, my daughter started high school on Tuesday.
That's
Crazy.
mad, you're 31.
I know, yeah, it's wild. I'm giving her all these hacks on like how to rule the playground and things, little like social hacks and stuff. But it's so easy when you're young, because everyone, you just rock up to, you know, you're in a room full of 30 other people with nothing else to do, and you're just spinning a yarn. Whereas when you get older, it's kind of harder to get into these situations, unless you go down to the pub every Friday, which isn't everyone's cup of tea, you know. I mean, the most common way people meet is through work, of course. But if you work at a small company, you've got like four people to pick from or whatever, it's challenging. But I think the best way to do that to maintain a high volume of connections is to regularly organize big group events, because it's like efficient, especially if you're an entrepreneur or you're busy or things. You know, be that guy who's just organizing big group events regularly, like once every month or every couple of months, and bring 30 people together. Especially now that we're a bit older and more classy, like your house isn't going to get bloody wrecked. Just have a dinner party, or like eight people over at your house or something like that. About to organize a bunch of people to go over to the Holi festival in Kumu. I live in Coatesville. You just throw color at each other, and they got DJs and stuff, and it's like a big, it's kind of like that tomato fest thing in Spain, but just with big colorful things. Just go along there with whoever wants to come can come. We just got a little group chat, and just yeah, whoever wants to join can join.
It's interesting. I'm just you, we'll talk about conversion and marketing FYI this, but I'm similar to you. Like everyone I approach, I feel as though there's something to learn from them. Like I think the best way to be a good connector of people or in sales is to find something interesting about everyone you meet. It's not easy. Sometimes what they how they say it is more interesting than what they say. But your approach is quite interesting. So because you essentially you have these large events where it pulls everyone together, and then in those events you wouldn't necessarily have to have those deep and meaningfuls and to go introspective and unpack emotions, but then you can still sustain a certain level of sociability.
It is. It's good. And like, I mean, at those, it's like, you know, you put something on, goes for 12, 15 hours or something. Throughout that, you're probably going to have like a dozen DMCs with people and
Oh,
things.
yeah, true.
It's efficient, you know, it's good. Whereas it's like, it's the same amount of time, effort, and energy to have a one-on-one catch up with someone. I still do that a lot. Like, I just link in with people. I think, like, I'm very big on maintaining social connections. I think it's so important. You follow Alex Hormozi, and he's just like, I don't go to any weddings. I don't respond to any invites. I go to bed at 7 p.m. every day, and I'm just like, nah, man. Like, it's not the vibe. It's like the reason you work so hard is so that you can self-actualize with the people that matter to you most. You know, that's like Mecca. That's like the pinnacle, Maslow's hierarchy of needs or whatever. You know, it's like it's why you're doing it all. So you've got the resources and the energy to be able to spend time with the people that matter to you. So important. But like I said, yeah, myself and a lot of the people that I spend my time with are very time poor, kind of busy. We've got lots of things we're focusing on. So I think everyone appreciates it if you can accommodate something that's sort of efficient. Mentorship's an interesting one too. I struggled to find a mentor when I was younger. I don't know. Just couldn't find one. I didn't really know where to look and things. I messaged a few people on LinkedIn and they just like weren't keen. And well, they wanted lots of money. And I'm just like, I think if there's money involved, it takes away from how good it is. I think it's better if it's like just, you know, a meaningful exchange between two people. And I did the Business Mentors NZ one for a while there, which I got loads out of. They paired me up with this accountant guy who was like, he just did a successful exit from his company, had loads of value to offer. And because he was an accountant, he gave me some really good like tax strategies and stuff, which is cool. But what I'm finding is that I haven't done it in like probably over a year now. But just having like a little mastermind group of like people that you respect their opinions. We just called it accountability bros, where it's just like, I don't know, a dozen of people that are quite goal oriented, have got some interesting stuff happening in their life that are trying to build something. And we just catch up once a month, go to breakfast or something. And we just talk about, what was your win for the month? Like, well, something you're proud of for the last month. Cause like Kiwis don't flex often. And it's just good to be able to just share something that you're stoked about with a room full of really supportive people that aren't going to try to cut you down. And then what's your goal for the next month? And then next month we catch up, we reflect back on the list of goals that everyone had just to see if you did it or not. It's like accountability I was talking about earlier, which is just really interesting. And a lot came out of that. And I found it more beneficial than having a one-on-one mentor because you've got 12 different people's perspectives that you're taking into consideration. And I mean, you get all that stuff out of the way in the first 10 minutes and you have a quick yarn. And then the rest of the hour is just like catching up with all these dudes, you know, it's just good. Again, efficient way to keep a deep connection with like lots of people at once.
Well, you talk about an interesting thing there around accountability.
Yeah.
And I'm a believer in the mentorship. I mean, I haven't achieved anything in life that wasn't a result of someone else telling me or supporting me.
Mm. How'd you find a mentor? Who are they?
I invited 100 people on a podcast. Talk to them.
Oh, you'd have some contacts.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's one guy had an idea. He's like, oh, there's all these other financial advisors. I want to like start a connection and we meet every month. Cool. And I was like, okay, cool. I'll set it up. So I just called a couple people. And then we meet up. But I was going to talk about this thing called the Mankind Projects. It's a bit woo woo. It has a weekend away, but every Monday is the good thing.
Hmm.
Where it's where other men hold each other to account and as well as unpack things that are holding them back in life.
Yep.
But the interesting thing they talk about is self-accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't give a fuck if I do what I say or not. They just care about why I didn't say what I said I would. Like I didn't keep my agreement. And they're just a witness to my own self-accountability.
Wow, okay.
How do you maintain accountability either for others or for yourself?
I guess I don't have a fixed mechanism for it. I find that the downside of letting someone down or yourself down or just looking like an idiot is enough. Just the act of having accountability is usually plenty. It's just like having a PT. It's like, yeah, they're giving you advice, but they're going to be checking back on you next week, you know, to see if you ate good or if you actually did the workout, you know. It's like, yeah, it's just accountability. It's just so much value in that. And that's why like a lot of people thrive better when they are employed. They have a boss, someone cracking the whip and making sure that report is ready by Friday. And when they're self-employed, the report will not be ready till the end of the month. Cause it's like, there's other things I could be focusing on that are like less friction, easier for me to do. I know the path forward. It's always hardest if you don't have a fixed process for it, you know?
The process they have for unpacking accountability is that there's often a belief system that's being fed.
Yeah.
So like, I'm not good enough. Mm. So I sabotage it in order to confirm that I'm not good enough. Or shame. So they talk about guilt is the currency you pay to forgive yourself. So you don't actually have to change anything if you're guilty enough.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Are you into affirmations?
No, but I can see why that'd be. Do you have one?
Oh yeah, I got like.
What's your creme de la creme?
I am in self-control.
Yeah, and how do you find affirmation serve your life?
It's like you said before. It's like you've got your values, your deep down ones. Whereas this is a way you can engineer them, as opposed to just letting them happen by default. You create your guiding values and you repeat them regularly, and then they start to work.
Makes sense. You had a defiant energy when you started describing your affirmations.
Yeah,
almost important. Combative, mate. Almost like you're ready for war.
Yeah. Well, it's again, they've served me well. And all of what I'm saying is just my own opinion. Everyone will have a different take on things. Mm. Not everyone will agree. Like you said before, it's polarity. There's nothing wrong with a little bit of polarity. It's good to stir the pot a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
And everything I say is just what's worked for me. And I've just done a lot of experimentation. It's kind of like CRO, right? It's just like everything that you're doing is just you come up with a hypothesis, you test it out in the real world, you look at the results. If it worked, great, I'll keep doing this. If it didn't, I'm going to chuck it in the bin and try something else. But for me, I've been doing this for over a decade, and I've tried a bunch of stuff. And at this point, my process, my goals, my affirmations are just like the 100th iteration. So they're very well refined, and they just work really well for me specifically. They wouldn't work for everyone else. Everyone needs their own ones. But what I practice works well for me.
Yeah, I can see it. Like, it would require a rigid discipline.
Yeah.
And as long as you maintain your routines and your framework, then, you know, and as I say, I can see it making you very successful. Okay. Speaking of return on investment, Is that CRO click? Is it... What does it stand for?
Conversion rate optimization.
Okay. I didn't actually know what that meant. So that's how good I am at conversion.
You're right.
So what should people be mindful of? So I see a lot of websites. There's not much thought into it. Do you think of conversion in terms of from the start, from the experience they're having with the initial ad, and then they go to another journey where there's an exchange of value to build trust, and it takes them on a story so they buy into what you're selling, and then from there is when you present the sale? Or how do you unpack conversion? What leads to a person buying something from your website?
All of those things you mentioned, there's lots. We definitely analyze conversion from the entire journey from ad through to website, but generally when we talk about CRO, it's on the website, because there's loads of stuff we do with the ads. Different ads convert at different rates, but the website. And these days, we all know how you purchase something, especially if it's a high ticket item or you're looking for a specific service or a product or anything. It's like you jump into Google a couple of questions, then you open up a few tabs with a few different options, and you pick the one you vibe with the best. That's all it is, right? And then CRO is engineering your business to be the obvious first choice compared to the others. That's what I call it, the obvious first choice principle. I've done a whole video on it. It's really all it is. There's a lot that goes into it, but if you boil it down, that's what it comes down to, is just making sure that you're the obvious one. If I'm looking for a financial advisor, it's like, all right, A, how do I get in front of the people that are searching for a financial advisor, or how do I find people that will be a good fit for it? And then B, even if you run an ad, you make this person wake them up to the fact that they need a financial advisor, they're still going to jump into Google and like go financial advisor best in Auckland or something like this. And they'll open a few tabs and they'll pick the one they vibe with the best. I see it all the time where a company will run all these ads, but because they aren't the obvious first choice, they're just steering the user through to Google and making a whole bunch of money for the competitors, you know. Happens all the time. So it's so important to just make sure that you come out at the top. And when it comes to conversion rate optimization, there's three things that are most important: reducing friction, increasing clarity, and making sure that your social proofing is really strong. Friction, clarity, social proof. If you can tick those three boxes, and if you look at your website and think, does it tick these three boxes? And also just be really frank with yourself. Open up your competitors' websites and put them side by side and think, if I was a customer, would I pick me? And I bet you, like 90% of the people watching this, the answer will be no, unless they've actually focused on this or, been working on it for a wee while. And I could talk for days about things that can improve those three factors, but that's really what it comes down to.
It's interesting. It's not too dissimilar. The APCO close, it's pretty well the same over in...
Oh, it's taking me back, mate. What's that? The awareness, interest.
Yeah. Well, you know, like I used to do signups. I don't know if you know that, Close. Like what everyone's doing today, really simple, just chipping in something small for a campaign next month.
Okay.
Keeping it going as long as they can. So should we get you down today? So the whole, exactly what you said. Yeah. Huh?
Nice assumptive close.
Yeah, something. Yeah, yeah. I'm normally indifferent close.
Okay.
Yeah. You're remembering all the, yeah. I use optional close, silent close, and indifferent the most. Just anyone listening, that's like a framework on how to communicate in the important moments. Like indifference, if you're leaning back, you're chill, it inherently adds value to what you're selling because it's like, why isn't he stressed or nervous? Or something is like you're helping them make a decision. An optional close is you're giving them options so they feel in control. A silent close is where you ask for something, you shut up, and then that puts social pressure on them to make a decision now.
There's a lot of power in silence. People don't realize. People get so uncomfortable in silence. But I love when a salesperson tries to use these tactics on me, even the silent close, and I'll just go silent back. And I'll take as long as it well wants, you know, I'll be there for a bloody 10 minutes if they want. It's hilarious. And then the guy's just sweating and it's just like, oh, it didn't work. Like, what do I do?
Yeah.
I really like the alternative close too, because it's like both options are them buying from you. It's like you want to buy this way, you want to buy this way. There's no third option. I find it fascinating. And a lot of these things you learn in sales, you can apply to marketing and ads and all sorts. So.
Yeah, I mean, all I see marketing is good sales.
Yeah. They're so integrated. And a lot of people, they look at them in two separate baskets. They look at their marketing and their sales like they're separate things, but they're like so just integrated. Or the best campaigns in the world are where they integrate them well. And you'll see it all the time where there'll be a fantastic marketing campaign, but the sales marketing handover is messy, or the person answering the phone is... not the receptionist good. Who happens to be a bitch or something. It's just like, you know, it's like, and then they're always going to point the finger at the market. It's like, it's all your fault. And it's like, okay, let's have a listen to the call recordings. We had one a while ago where we generated 70 phone calls in a month and they only picked up the phone 11 times. And they're just like, never mind. We'll fix that. You know, like, and they're real angry at us. Like it wasn't working. It's like, that's why you always record the calls. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Cause like, you know, I've trained quite a lot of salespeople now from APCO and from other things. And it's so easy, just even when you're training them, even though you have influence over their belief system, even though there's an expectation that you're there to help, they'll still blame the leads.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, how do you navigate that in the marketing world? Because I like to have authentic relationships and I'm incentivized for the success of the client. And if they're full of shit, I have to tell them, hey, look, you know, this is you.
Yeah, yeah. Record the calls. Just Avanza, it's like you familiar? So you can install a piece of code on your website so that when the lead comes from Google Ads, it switches the phone number out dynamically.
Yeah.
And then from Facebook Ads, it'll switch the number out again. So at the end of the month, you can actually listen to all the calls from all the different sources and you can analyze. And again, circles back to CRO, because then you can optimize your pitch and everything. It's brilliant. And as the CEO or business owner, you can analyze how your salespeople are handling the calls. You can see if they're taking the piss or wasting your money, because sometimes it can cost you $100 to generate a phone call if you look at, you know, cost per inquiry or whatever, if you're in a really competitive industry. And if they're just, you know, failing on the phone call, it's like and you got 10 phone calls through, so you just wasted $1,000, you know, like, and once clients realize this and they get on top of it and we help them with it as well, then really good things can happen. But it's like, you've got to remove the option for them to be able to take the piss out of you. Otherwise they will. It's all the marketer's fault. And that's why a good CRM is really good. And just obviously having all your analytics and tracking set up. Like occasionally I still see marketers running campaigns without setting tags in GTM first. And I'm just like, what the hell are you doing? Like you're literally just like shooting in the dark.
Google Tag Manager.
Yeah, correct. So obviously you need to track how many form submissions or phone number clicks or email address clicks are happening in a month. As opposed to just setting your Google Ads live and just like sort of hoping for the best. Like, yeah, you'll probably get some phone calls, but you don't know how many, and you can't improve things and you can't use that data to optimize your campaigns and things. It's like, you need to know what's working so you can head more in that direction. That's kind of all we do.
So you're the math man or the art man, or what are you in the business?
The architect.
The architects and the ideas of pulling it all together.
I'll come up with a plan, the big picture plan, but my team will do all the actual managing of the ads and things, but I'm in very close communications with all of them. Which has been great because I can see what this person's doing on this campaign. And usually they'll only come to me if something's really failing. you know, if it's like, oh, we're trying everything with this campaign and it's just not getting the inquiries through. So I'll give them a couple of ideas, some experiments to run. They'll run it and we'll reanalyze. But I'll go through that process with one person and then I can use all those learnings to help the rest of the team. And it's just like, oh, by the way, everyone, like Lucy did this really cool campaign. Yeah, you guys could try it out for these clients. It could work really well. And then all the clients get to benefit every time we learn something. So.
So then what differentiates a good campaign from a bad campaign? I know it's abstract, so you can go specific.
Nah, I don't think it's abstract. For me, I like to give every client, just ask them from day one, what does success look like in 6 months and in 5 years? Like what is success to you? And there's your metric. 90% of the time it's revenue based or leads based. And I'll always try to get that number out of them. How many leads do we need a month? You know, what's your current monthly revenue and how much do you want to make a month in an ideal world? And it surprises me how often the business owner doesn't even bloody know. They're like, oh yeah, I think we do this much a month. Usually they'll know their monthly revenue, but they don't know what their goal revenue would be. And the thing is, an extra 20 grand a month is an absolute life changer for a lot of business owners. Absolute life changer. And it's not even that bloody hard, you know? Usually any digital campaign will get you between a 3 to a 7x return, like if it's good. That's like the bog standard. Obviously there's outliers and some just go ballistic, but that's like an average. So if you know that you're going to be able to put a dollar in and get $6 back, like just keep putting fuel on the fire until you start to plateau. And like there's that analogy, right? It's like if you had a machine, you could put a dollar in and it'll spit $2 out. Then you had another machine, you put a dollar in and it spits $3 out. Which one would you pick? Most people would pick the second machine, but the correct answer is just fucking feed both of them. You know, if you're going to double your money, just, you know, put $500 a day into both of them, mate, and the money's going to start stacking up. And like a lot of people don't know if they should do Facebook ads or Google ads or experiment with TikTok or SEO or whatever it is. Just whatever works, do that. And scale it until you start to, you know, plateau, because obviously New Zealand's a small place, so everyone's going to plateau after a certain period of time.
Yeah, so this, you make an interesting point there about saturation. Because in essence, if I went and sell to, let's say, everyone in Auckland, and I kept doing the same thing, made slight adjustments, but the offer is fundamentally the same, and there's an exchange of I'm asking consistently, and then eventually that leads, I lose equity in terms of the relationship with that person. Is there a way... Do you ever think about brand in conjunction with performance, or is it just too hard to scale as a business?
How do you mean? Like non-conversion focused campaigns, you mean? Or what? Yeah, I mean, occasionally the client will come to us with that as an objective, especially if they're a larger corporate. It's pretty important to them, non-conversion focused things. But we price based on objective, not on kind of like, because like it's like you could have a tiny little company that has 10 objectives and that's going to take us a really long time versus this massive company with huge ad spend, but they only just want to get leads through for their tutoring company, you know? So it's like one objective and we can think of 1,001 ways to do that versus this other guy over here who wants to, you know, actually wants to focus on like reach and awareness, and they're selling like 8 different services and each of them needs their own campaign and stuff like this. Yeah, so it just depends on what the objective is. But if the objective is ever non-conversion focused, it's like a freaking walk in the park. It's so easy. Like we barely have to try for those. Like anyone can do that. It's easy to get reach and awareness, but like what's the bloody point? We would only ever really run reach and awareness campaigns top funnel. So it's like you're familiar with like the video views remarketing stuff. Like it's, you know, run a video at the top of the funnel and then remarket to, you pick a point in the video where it's like, all right, if they watch up to here, they're probably a good warm lead. And then you remarket to anyone who's watched up to that point in the video. Those work really, really well. Especially if you're serving the video as a YouTube ad based on search intent. So it's like people that have searched anything to do with financial advice in the last 6 months, serve this video to them, you know, based on what they're Googling. That one works really well. And YouTube ads are way underutilized in New Zealand currently. You get such a low CPM compared to like Facebook and stuff.
Where do you think the underpriced attention is? Because I haven't tried it because I don't do any paid ads.
Sure.
But Facebook brought in a way to target B2B, whether they can and how easy that is. And then Instagram Reels is a competitive feature to TikTok, so it's relatively less competitive. Where are you finding underpriced attention?
I mean, TikTok's the obvious one at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you're getting a cost per lead, CPM, CPC of like a tenth of Facebook currently. So cheap, but less people taking the desired action if you take them off TikTok. More people are buying from Facebook than TikTok. But because of the sheer reach, if you've got everything else set up correctly, it works really well. If you're just using TikTok as a top funnel, you know, get them in the, get them to submit a lead form or something like this, and then you do the rest with sales, then it can work phenomenally well because it's so cheap. That's a really good one. Another one that not many people are focusing on is Pinterest ads.
Yeah.
Again, a tenth of the cost of everything else, 70% high demographic, you know, like people earning more than six figures, 90% female. So if you've got a product or service, or you can frame your product or service around high demographic female, and then you can come up with creative and copy that fits within the platform, looks sort of inspirational somehow, which is sort of hard for B2B services a lot of the time, but you can always do it. Then you can win, and better conversion from Pinterest than say TikTok, for example. People are there to be inspired and look for new things, and they're happy to go off the platform once they see something, as opposed to TikTok. It's like, you don't want to leave TikTok. You're there for half an hour to just kill some time or whatever. But Facebook, Instagram is just still the best for just sales conversion. People can make lots of money with Facebook ads.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, Google's better, of course, because they're further along the conversion cycle. But when we're looking at social, Facebook and Instagram.
Is YouTube Shorts coming in as an opportunity?
Hugely. Not many people realize, but soon, it might have already happened, they're doing a revenue share with Shorts. 50% of all the money your YouTube makes from your Shorts goes to the creator, which what I think is going to happen is all the TikTok creators obviously are going to jump across to YouTube Shorts. The UX UI of Shorts is inferior to TikTok currently, but it's just a matter of time before they catch up. It's like the algorithm isn't as polished, but it will get there, I think, once there's more content there to serve and things like that, and once people migrate across, which will be interesting to see how TikTok responds to that, because, I mean, they're going to have to start paying their creators eventually. They'll reach a point where it starts to die off a little bit, but who knows? There could be a whole nother platform coming out in 5 years that we just can't even conceive currently. I remember when in like the real early days, Gary V was like, when it was called Musical.ly, he's like, Musical.ly is going to be the next best thing. And you know, I was like, okay, I'll take a look at this. And I was like, what the hell, like, no one's gonna, like, people aren't gonna be like dancing on a camera to stuff. And it's just like, I thought he was wrong. And then sure enough, you know, changed the name to TikTok and it bloody took off. Because you don't think at the time it's more than just a dancing thing. It's like you can do thought leadership and authoritative content and talking heads and all this. And it's interesting. You just never know which way it's going to go.
I think the most important thing to realize from that content component is that if you're feeling that, so is everyone else.
Yeah.
And if there's users there,
and
if it, like, he's been wrong a lot.
Yeah.
And right a lot. But he's been on both. So he's curious about, like, Be Reals. I was like, fuck, I hate taking pictures. I don't want to do it.
Awful.
Yeah. And I went on it and I tried it. And then I was trying to make curious because I know I'd be resisting it and telling. And then it's the anti-influencer is the idea. Or Clubhouse. He started talking about Clubhouse. Yeah. And I went on there and I was like, it's just a horrible experience.
Awful.
But I still try to remain curious because I wasn't particularly good at content, but I was early on TikTok.
Yep.
And that just gave me access to a massive audience.
Yeah, it's great.
But they tend to be younger because younger people tend to be more malleable and open.
That's true, yeah. Although like the 25 plus age bracket is jumping across there in droves. It's just going ballistic. It's kind of like when everyone, it's kind of like how all the old people are jumping on Facebook. Like the same thing's happening for like millennials jumping across to TikTok currently, so.
Well, it always happens.
Yeah.
And guess who the kids are showing it to? Their parents as
exactly,
well.
Exactly.
But Facebook Reels, as you talk about, like, so Facebook, it was an aging demographic because who the fuck uses Facebook?
Yeah.
But now Facebook Reels has mass reach and you got an older demographic, but yet people still won't go on there.
It's great for conversions though, if it's an older demographic, because they got the money, you know? So it's like, obviously it's, and like they're more susceptible to the ads, like, our brains are sort of accustomed just as soon as you identify that it's an ad, scroll straight past, unless it's a really bloody good ad. Best ads just call out the persona in like the first, you know, in the copy and the creative and everything. It's just like, financial advisors in Auckland, watch this. You know, it's just like, okay, you have my attention now. Okay. For like 1.5 seconds. And if you can give me some value in like under 3 seconds, then I'll probably consider like watching the rest of your video. If you've got a good thumb stopper concept or something like this, it's, yeah, there's so much to it, but A lot of it hasn't actually changed since old school marketing. Like one of our strategists at Flow, he's seen the entire journey from like, he ran Google Ads when Google Ads was brand new, when you like your CPC was like 1 cent, and like he's bit senior, and he's just seen the entire journey. So he's incredibly talented at like long form direct response copywriting and all these things that worked really well in like print days, when being a marketer was like how good you could write ad copy. And you look at some of these like Ogilvy ads from like the 50s, and it's like it's a work of art. Like some of these things, just the clarity that they can get to with so few words, and just the impact of a simple image and things, which I think these days in marketing people have gone away from because it's too easy, and we've got like Midjourney and ChatGPT and all these like things that just make it too easy. You don't have to really think about it. So like employing some of those old school copywriting techniques to modern day ads work really frickin' well, so long as you just sort of apply the contemporary principles to it.
Well, just we're almost at an hour. I'm not sure what your time constraint is.
None. I'm chill.
Well, I love this topic.
Can I get some more water? Or are we going to keep going for a bit, or are we nearly done?
I think we're nearly done. Yeah, because I was gonna say that. Yeah, humans don't change much, and I think advertising is just a reflection of human behavior. What your competitors do and how you differentiate yourself from the markets, you know, changes. TikTok is, I understand you can go New Zealand, but you can't go specific.
It's really annoying.
Obviously I've heard of Pinterest from Neil Patel. He's the conversion guru from what I can gather. And you know, I should look into it. With TikTok, I can see you reach a lot of people and it's broad, and then maybe do you need a large offering that can be serviced across New Zealand, or because it's interest-based, or how are you using TikTok strategically?
A couple of things. So firstly, yeah, nationwide is a bit of a pain, so it works better for like e-com or nationwide companies. But if you're in Auckland, a quarter of our population's here. So if you just run a TikTok ad, there'll be a bit of wastage, but bugger all. And I'd say most of the TikTok users will be here, probably like half, I'd say, or something. So although there's wastage, if you're getting a CPA, CPC of a tenth of what it costs elsewhere, even after you take the wastage into account, it's still a better deal. So there's that. And then there's obviously the organic side of TikTok, which is just huge. Pretty much anyone who posts regularly, like every day on TikTok, eventually you're going to get a video, get 100K views. Like one will get picked up. It just will if you're good. You just will. And it's just a numbers game, because a small percentage of those are going to click through to your profile and give you a stalk, and a smaller percentage are actually going to click the link in the bio. Or, I mean, my biggest piece of advice for organic content creators on TikTok is just to make sure you have a commercially focused post, those first three at the top pinned, just like how to work with me. Because so many people are going to stalk your business and then they see all these cool videos and then they disappear. But if there's the first video, it's like, all right, how to work with Ryan J. Melton and get your financial advice. And the second one will be like the value points of working with a bloody financial advisor, and the third one could be like some social proofing, for example, because then there's a path to the conversion, and that those three videos are going to be what influences them to click the link in the bio. You sort of need to warm them up a little bit, you know. And so many people don't do this. It seems pretty obvious, but just do that. You'll make lots of money.
I'll do that. All right, well, I'm trying to navigate the fact that you're dying of thirst and that we're almost finished. So
you're right.
I guess we should just call it then. What would be, who should reach out to you and why?
So at the agency, we specialize in lead generation style marketing, especially for any product or service that's worth more than $1,000. So high ticket items. And that's like $1,000 throughout the entire lifetime of that customer being with you. Got a lot of clients in the education sector, some in the automotive, but we can kind of help anyone in New Zealand so long as it's a high ticket item and you want to just get more inbound inquiries. You want the phone to ring, you want more emails through. We look at marketing very holistically. It's not just about how can we fit this client into Google Ads or Facebook Ads. It's like, let's zoom out and look at it as though we were the business owner. How can we improve your sales process, your systems, do you have a CRM, just absolutely everything. And we've learned a lot from a lot of our other clients that we can sort of use to benefit new clients that jump on board. Flow.co.nz, our website, or on all the social platforms at Flow Marketing NZ.
Cool. Well, I took a lot from it. So thank you for coming.
No worries, man. Good to meet you.
You too, brother.
Good man.